In the late summer of 1917, after arriving in France, former Princeton football and hockey great Hobey Baker, along with the other American pilots in his squadron, began their training program to prepare themselves for aerial combat, training that was not without its own challenges.
In diving on a balloon used as a target, Hobey tried to maintain his fire until very close.
Baker's commanding officer and a Princeton alum, Charles Biddle, wrote the Princeton Alumni Weekly about an accident that Hobey encountered during his training.
He riddled the balloon, but misjudged his distance and ran into it just as he was pulling away. The impact shattered his propeller and badly strained the machine, and the cloth of the balloon became wrapped around one wing and thereby threw the plane out of balance. Those watching on the ground held their breath and gave him up for lost. But Hobey was one of those who never give up and realized that in aviation, the surest way to lose your life is to lose your head. By the most skillful handling of his crippled machine, he was able to bring it safely to the ground, to the great delight and astonishment of his French audience.
Baker was born to fly, on the gridiron, on the ice, and now through the air. Hobey loved being a fighter pilot. For him, the air war was the ultimate sport. In a letter to his father, he described the commonality between football and flying.
You handle your machine instinctively, just as you dodge instinctively when running with the ball in an open field.
But aerial dogfights in World War I were a much more deadly competition than what Hobey experienced in football. And World War I pilots had their own unique expression for what occurred too often when flying, going west. In short, dying. The life expectancy for World War I pilots was shockingly short.
Over the course of the war, it could range from 2 weeks to 6 weeks.
Jeremy Kinney is a World War I aviation expert and associate director of research for the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum.
There are about 600 pilots when they start in the summer of 1917, and they lose 235 killed in action. In addition to that, it's 45 killed in accidents.
I'm David Duchovny. From 30 for 30 Podcasts, this is Searching for Hobey Baker, Episode 3, Going West. Although it was just over a decade since the Wright brothers' first flight at Kitty Hawk, the airplane played a critical role in World War I, as aeronautical technology evolved rapidly over the course of the war. There were three classes of planes used during the war: bombers, scout planes, and fighters, known as pursuit planes. The top pilots, like Hobey, flew these pursuit planes, many from elite colleges, Harvard, Princeton, Brown, and Yale. Despite fielding the best and the brightest pilots, the U.S. Army Air Service had a bumpy beginning. As described by Samuel Hines in his classic book on America's World War I air war, Unsubstantial Air.
The Air Service would enter the war in Europe 2.5 years late, ill-equipped, ill-trained, and undermanned. A 19th-century army in the world's first 20th-century war.
As a result, Baker and his fellow American pilots spent most of their first year grounded, flying desks for lack of enough aircraft or proper airfields. In a letter home, Hobey's colleague, Quentin Roosevelt, son of former President Teddy Roosevelt, bemoaned their slow start.
Dear father and mother, we have now about 600 non-flying cadets here with nothing in the world for them to do, and apparently no chance of their flying in the next couple of months. The future is crammed with any number of possibilities, most of them highly discouraging.
While waiting impatiently for his first aerial combat, Hobey also became a fervent letter writer as well, writing scores of letters home to his father Alfred, and also to Percy Pine. Pine was 9 years older than Hobey, a Princeton alum and heir to a family sugar and banking fortune. After Hobey graduated from Princeton in 1914, he lived with Percy for over 2 years in his New York City mansion. Then, when Hobey went off to war, Percy continued to send a stream of care packages, including cigarettes, underwear, shirts from Brooks Brothers, candy, and photos. Hobie's letters to Percy are now in the Baker Archives at Princeton University. They provide us an intimate window into the nature of their evolving relationship. September 21st, 1917, Pau, France.
Dear Percy, for heaven's sake, don't stop writing me, even if I am here for a year, for I can't tell you what your letters mean to me.
September 27th, 1917.
At times, I don't miss you at all. And then again, I get horrible homesick and get thinking of the wonderful times we had when we weren't scrapping. And I wonder if they will ever be again, or whether this damn war is going to end it all.
December 29th, 1917. Arcachon, France.
Percy, the picture of you came also. I think the one standing is wonderful. The other, not so good. But that one standing could not be better, and I love it. When I feel especially dirty, I shall look at that picture. These photos sort of connect me up again.
David Doyle is a professor of history at Southern Methodist University and an authority on same-sex relationships in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
The bar is always much higher in same-sex relationships because people are trying to either cover them up or prove that, you know, something deviant happened, especially when we get into the 20th century.
So to name this as love or affection or sex between two men is to criticize them, to ruin their reputation, to say something quite negative about them, and that's why the bar gets set high. I think the more we come to accept that there's nothing wrong with gayness, the bar will lower.
Professor Nicholas Surrett is an associate dean at the University of Kansas and editor of the Journal of the History of Sexuality.
The bars are set in very, very different places, and I think it's not just the presumption of heterosexuality, though it's that. It is also that the reason I think we struggle so hard to name couples as being whatever they would have called themselves, being sexually, romantically involved, is that for many people still, homosexuality was seen as a bad thing.
Might Hobie have thought of himself as gay or bisexual? Surrett notes that the pressure to label one's identity didn't exist in the same way 100 years ago.
I think he could have thought of himself as gay, but he also might not have. That is, it's possible that he also found himself attracted to women, and so that would preclude a very rigid understanding of homosexuality in that, you know, attraction to both sexes.
Now, a century later, no one can say for sure the exact nature of Hobie's personal relationship with Percy. And unfortunately, the large cache of World War I letters that Percy wrote to Hobie, which would have afforded us a fuller and better understanding, were either destroyed or lost. But there is compelling evidence that Percy and Hobie were most likely in a loving relationship. We asked Professors Nicholas Surrett and David Doyle to examine Hobie's letters to Percy, along with contemporary accounts to shed light for us on Hobie and Percy's relationship. Nick Surrett.
To me, it sounds like definitely affection, absolutely attraction, and I would lean towards sex. Did they think that this was going to be forever? That I have a very difficult time sort of speculating about. There is clearly affection and longing when they are separated from one another.
David Doyle concurs.
Love, affection, attraction, sex, romantic friendship, lovers, in some ways, all are possible. I wouldn't use something like the term homosexual because I am very certain that Hobie Baker would not have identified in that way. What we can say is same-sex or opposite-sex attractions transcends time and place, but one's culture, one's historical moment changes. So the way it's interpreted or understood is different. So by reading these letters, I would say this relationship is very central, very important to his life.
One fact that both professors cite is Hobie's decision in September 1914 to move in with Percy in New York City, living with him for over 2 years, even though Percy was well known for being gay. Professor Surrett.
As a historian who tries to piece together, you know, pieces of the sexual past of people, we're always looking for clues. And sometimes the clues are little more than breadcrumbs. But this is a pretty big clue. That one figure was so sort of universally known to be queer. If another person chooses to live with them, to be involved with them, that to me is a fairly strong signal about what might be going on.
October 10th, 1917, Cazaux, France.
I had such a vivid dream about you last night, and it was so strong, it sort of stayed with me all day. I went somewhere to meet you, and was terribly glad to see you.
Reading those letters by Hobie, I read genuine affection and playfulness there that I think would be difficult to... It's fakeable, but that's not how it reads to me.
October 13th, 1917.
If you were here, life would be so different to me. I am at present very depressed. I wish you had not sent me that picture in a way, for it makes me want to see you so much.
Many decades later in the 1960s, when John Davies, a Princeton alum, wrote the first biography of Hobie, he asked Hobie's friends and teammates to share their memories. He did not ask them to comment on Hobie's or Percy's sexuality or relationship. But some did anyway. One of those was Wendell Kuhn, a close friend of Hobie and his hockey teammate at both their prep school, St. Paul's, and Princeton.
Now, I've heard sinister implications put upon Hobie's relation with Percy. I don't swallow that for one moment. Don't believe it. Completely out of character for Hobie. And I resent this sort of backstairs gossip and loathe the contemptible people who indulge in it. I think it's vicious and salacious. The fact that Percy Pine never married is scant proof of what is inferred here.
I have read some of those reminiscences by classmates, friends of Hobie Baker, and many of them were penned or spoken in the middle of the 20th century, which was a time of particular persecution for gay and lesbian people. So they were, in essence, trying to save their friend from the stain, the taint of homosexuality. Many people who say, no, there's no way, don't actually know gay people. And so what they know is this version of homosexuality, which they perceive as being diseased and negative. So their Hobie could not possibly be like that.
In his numerous letters to Percy and also to his father, Hobie wrote vividly about his war experiences and how his life as a World War I pilot differed from the grim existence of soldiers fighting in the trenches. While the air war was a high-stakes and deadly game, it was one that was played with honor and respect for their German foes and also included moments of wonder. May 7th, 1918.
Dear Father, I never get used to the beauty of clouds from above. Chasms, mountains, plains, they were all there, done in great billowing masses, pink-tinted in spots by the setting sun.
But on the ground, there was no such natural beauty. May 15th, 1918.
You can't imagine the horrible feeling of the whistle of those bombs coming down and the terrific explosions which shake the ground like an earthquake.
Author Samuel Hines also noted the disparity.
Once the cavalry charge with pennants flying had proved suicidal against machine guns, aviation was the only kind of combat left in which one man mounted on a machine instead of a horse could fight a personal war. If the big words of war, glory and honor and chivalry and romance, applied anywhere in this vast conflict, it would be in the air.
To relieve the stress of aerial combat, many American pilots found their way to Paris on days off, another luxury not afforded soldiers in the trenches. Wartime had not entirely dampened the City of Lights, which continued to revel in bohemian delights. Groundbreaking African-American musicians like James Reese Europe mingled with artists, writers, European royalty, and high society. Hobie wrote to his father about one of his Paris forays. August 15th, 1918.
Dear Father, took the morning train to Paris and had quite a party with Cole Porter at his apartment, where we sang and he played. He is very good.
During the war, Baker reignited his college friendship with famed 20th century songwriter Cole Porter. When Baker was at Princeton, Porter attended Yale, where he was a composer of the college's beloved fight song, Bulldog. And like Hobie, Porter sang in his college choir and was also a Yale cheerleader, giving him a front row seat on Hobie's football exploits during Princeton-Yale games. Susan Weiss is an emeritus professor at Johns Hopkins and a leading Cole Porter scholar. Weiss describes the parallels between the two Ivy Leaguers.
Going to boarding schools, being interested in music, Cole is a jock-type sports fan. He was a wannabe athlete. And perhaps, I think, in many ways, Hobie was a wannabe musician.
Cole Porter saw all the Yale-Princeton games. From the singing that they did together, they were both in Ivy League glee clubs that would travel to each other's venues.
Hobie biographer Tim Rapley.
I researched what Cole Porter's parties were all about, and it's copious amounts of opium and Indian royalty and cross-dressing and bisexuality. These parties were insane.
In December 1917, Hobie attended a soiree at Cole's Paris apartment where he met the heiress and New York City debutante Mimi Scott, who was a Red Cross nurse. In Paris, Mimi and Cole had become good friends, often singing together.
She was an interesting person, too, because she went and served in the relief as a nurse. And in terms of the music, she must have been good because Cole didn't have a high tolerance for people who were not talented.
Cole, who was known to be gay, was enamored both with athletes and men in uniform. He even wrote a song, Pilot Me, full of double entendres about the Flyers he adored.
Pilot me, be the pilot I need, please give my ship a maiden trip and we'll get the prize for speed.
Wilfried Vandenbrand is also a leading Cole Porter expert and a renowned singer of his songs.
So cast away your fears, shift my gears, let me carry you through, and when afraid you are of going too far, then I'll just pilot you. Pilot me could be a tribute to Hobie. You feel Cole Porter's amazement and admiration for the aviator, so I do think that he would have been in awe, not just for the football man, but being such a hero.
But on that cold December night in Paris, Hobie was less taken with Cole Porter than he was with Miss Mimi Scott. Mimi was from great wealth. Her father, George, was a successful banker, and her mother, the daughter of a French count. The Scotts maintained homes in New York City, Newport, and Palm Beach. On paper, Hobie and Mimi made quite a pair. The famous American athlete and army aviator whose family money had mostly vanished, and the uber-wealthy Newport socialite who was a Red Cross nurse. It read like a page out of Hemingway's World War I novel, A Farewell to Arms. In August 1918, Hobie wrote home with exciting news.
Dear Father, well, it is all fixed, and we are engaged. Don't quite understand how I put it across, but I did, and she is so much what I have always wanted that I feel all sort of safe and happy. She is a very decided sort of person, with lots of brains. Not beautiful, but oh, I don't know, just so sweet and big and real.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power, so how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and, of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/30for30. That's oracle.com/30for30. oracle.com/30for30.
The impending nuptials were the talk of the society pages back home. The New York Sun even described how Hobie proposed to Mimi, a story perhaps long on romantic fantasy.
Now he was somewhere along the battlefront doing his bit. Hobie Baker was more than doing his bit. He was doing his all. And one day, while Mimi Scott was busy nursing her men, there was a great whirring in the air. It was Hobie Baker flying on the wings of the wind to the girl he loved. Down he swooped and landed lightly, A few hours later, that little plane went into the air again. It swooped and dived and pirouetted joyously. For hadn't its pilot asked a question that day and received an answer? Within a few days, the announcement was made. Mrs. George S. Scott announces the engagement of her granddaughter, Mimi Scott, to Lieutenant Hobart A.H. Baker of Philadelphia.
Due to his own financial constraints, Hobie hit Percy up for $500 to buy an engagement ring. Hobie later expressed his concern about the huge differences between Mimi's economic status and his own.
Dear father, I wish she did not have so much money and I had more. What will I do if I live through this war? I am worth about a franc a week to Thornton. We will figure on living through this war, but the chances are not good.
But some of Hobie's close friends were less than enthralled with Mimi. Fellow aviator and Princeton alum Charles Biddle expressed his doubts about Mimi in a letter to Hobie biographer John Davies.
She was a good-looking girl, in a flashy sort of way, what the French would call chic, but my impression of her was that she was hard and had no sweetness. To me, she had no charm at all, and I remember being very dubious of Hobie's prospects for happiness if he should marry her.
Hobie's engagement, in fact, fits with the social norms of the time, norms that countless other same-sex-loving men had to follow, including Cole Porter, who, despite being gay, married a wealthy older heiress shortly after the war.
Lots of men who identified as gay got married to women and had, you know, varying degrees of success in their relationships if they were not sexually attracted to their wives. You can imagine some people being able to fake it well and others not so well. The wealthier, the more high profile a person was, the more expectations there were upon them to marry and to live out societal ideals, which generally were, you know, marriage and a family.
And the fact that Percy gave Hobie the modern day equivalent of $10,000 to buy Mimi's engagement ring does not surprise Professor Surrett.
Part of it hinges on what they thought their future was. So if they were involved in a sexual affectionate relationship, but perhaps Hobie did not think that he could do this in the long term, but that they very much cared for one another, it's completely possible that they also talked about the fact that Hobie at some point was going to have to get married. That Percy might contribute to the engagement ring doesn't surprise me in that context. I also think that it wouldn't surprise me at all even if he had gotten married and they had continued their relationship, as we know many gay men who got married to women did.
Meanwhile, as World War I dragged into its ever more bloody and horrific fourth year, Hobie's letters to Percy took on an increasingly intimate and personal tone. April 4th, 1918, Chaloux, France.
Dear Percy, I suppose if you ever get here, I would never see you even once. Wouldn't that be hell? You would probably work at Tours and I on the front, and since no permissions for leave are granted for Paris, I don't know where we would meet. You are still a long way off, and I may be dead and buried by the time you get here.
July 9th, 1918, Toul, France.
Wouldn't it be queer to see each other again? You, I know, will look just the same, possibly a little larger fellow around the belt. I am almost as bald as Thornton, and getting more so each day. I don't think you would know me, for I feel I have changed quite a lot as far as looks go.
A few months earlier, Percy heard a disturbing rumor that Hobie had been killed in action. Learning of this, Hobie sought to reassure Percy. December 13, 1917, Arcachon, France.
Percy, I am sorry that you should have worried about my being killed. It is a rumor that has gone everywhere, and everyone I see seems to think I am a ghost. I was afraid the rumor might get back home and felt like cabling that the news of my death was exaggerated. Why you care so damn much will always be a mystery, but that I care more than I ever thought I did is more than apparent to me now.
Yet the ever-present specter of death, of going west, was never far from Hobie's mind.
Dear Father, there couldn't be a nicer way to die. If I go west, it would be a pleasant death, a quick and sure one.
And Baker's fellow pilot, Quentin Roosevelt, also wrote about going west, February 23rd, 1918.
Dear father and mother, still, there's no better way if one has got to die. It solves things so easily, for you've nothing to worry about it. And even the people whom you leave have the great comfort of knowing how you died. It's really a very fine 30 seconds of horror, and it's all over.
Sadly, in July 1918, Quentin Roosevelt was shot down by the Germans. He was just 20 years old. A grisly photo of his dead, limp body laying next to his plane was used by the Germans as propaganda.
It actually backfired in Germany because there was sentiment towards Theodore Roosevelt as they liked him.
The Smithsonian's Jeremy Kinney.
So that story resonates quite a lot with the American public in terms of here's a pilot that gave his life, but he was the president's son. Theodore Roosevelt doesn't live 6 months after this. He's racked with guilt because he encouraged his sons into military service.
In April 1918, after almost a year of training and impatiently waiting, Hobie finally saw combat. After being assigned to the Lafayette Escadrille, one of the top American fighter units. In late May, he shot down his first German plane, which he described in a letter to his father, using a derisive term for his German opponents.
It was the biggest thrill of my life. I'm still all excited over it, just as I used to be after a big game. We went way into Bosch lines, over their balloons. I don't think I got a Bosch, but I came very close. Report just came in. The boys got two of them. Just as I was writing this, two have been confirmed and I am wild with joy. I am so excited I can hardly write. I wish you could have seen the fight. I was so excited I forgot to be scared.
For Baker, the Great War gave him a sense of fulfillment, a purpose he hadn't experienced since his days at Princeton. As World War I author Alan Moorhead wrote, he was, for a moment of time, a complete man. In August 1918, Hobie's leadership talents were acknowledged when he was given command of his own pursuit squadron. He wrote to his friend Wendell Kuhn about his plans to paint his squadron's planes in Princeton's colors and use the school's tiger mascot as well.
Dear Wendell, it may be rah-rah, but I am having all the plane's radiators painted orange and black and a tiger's head for the squadron insignia. It will be damn pretty.
In late October 1918, Hobie, now a squadron leader, managed to get his second shoot-down of a German plane. In a letter to his father, he revealed the surreal intimacy of aerial dogfights.
Dear father, he got over a woods, and I lost him for a few valuable seconds, then picked him up as he shot across a road directly below me. I dove again and came out on his tail where I commenced firing at close range. He pulled a climbing turn and came up over me. I saw the pilot look down and would recognize him if I saw him on a street. We were so close. He was a beautiful pilot in a beautiful machine. I fired 150 rounds into him at close range.
Hobie now had his second of three confirmed kills, with a third coming a few days later. But then, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, November 11th, 1918, World War I ended with Germany's surrender and an Allied victory. Disappointed that he did not become an ace with five kills, Hobie writes home.
Dear Father, I am very well pleased with the work of the squadron. We lost no men and have two Germans to our credit in 2 weeks of operating. I'm glad it's over, but I would not have minded a few more weeks to get this squadron at its height of efficiency.
But as the war ended, so too did his engagement to Miss Mimi Scott. November 27th, 1918.
Dear Father, I think she is in love with some man in Paris. It seems so queer, for she made me feel so sure of her. We really had been engaged for about 5 months, but I was anxious not to announce it until after the war. I believe she honestly believed she loved me until the right one came along. I am certainly good when it comes to girls. Someday, Father, I want to have a long talk with you about Mimi.
40 days after the war ended, on December 21st, 1918, Hobie Baker, now a captain, finally received his orders to return home. But Hobie wanted to remain in France with his pursuit squadron, stay until they could all go home together. So Hobie rode his Harley-Davidson to the squadron's headquarters to plead for his discharge orders to be countermanded. But his request was denied. After returning to the Toul airfield that cold, rainy December day, Hobie encountered his old Princeton football coach and mentor, Lieutenant Hef Herring. In a letter to the Princeton Alumni Weekly, Herring wrote a detailed account of what happened that day.
The rain still pouring down, Hobie burst into his quarters. All he now wanted was one last hop in a SPAD. The Air Service personnel had its superstitions, chief among them that no one should ever take an avowed last flight. We were still arguing as we walked to the field. All I had gained was a promise to fly straight out to Pont-à-Mousson, turn round, and come home, with no acrobatics anywhere.
But when Herring and Hobie reached the hangar, Hobie's plane was at the back. Hobie didn't want to put his men out by moving the other planes around, so he took the nearest one, which had just had its faulty motor repaired.
Hobie jumped in the cockpit and promised me once again he'd go easy, just up and back from Pont-à-Mousson. It might take him 15 minutes. With the motor thoroughly warmed up, Hobie headed into the wind. With the motor delivering full power, he suddenly pulled up in a right chandelle.
Chandelle is a French term for a steep, vertical climb. In short, Hobie had executed an aerial acrobatic, breaking his minutes-old promise to Hef.
Hobie had flown perhaps a quarter mile after leveling off and was approaching the little square of trees and barn, just here at the worst possible place and fraction of time. His motor cut out.
Baker, instead of doing what he had done many times before, gliding the plane straight forward to a pancake landing, instead tried to turn his powerless plane back towards the airstrip.
He made a right turn, lost flying speed, and began to fall off on a wing. He then did the only thing that might have possibly saved him had he just a little more altitude. He turned the nose straight down. About 90 feet from the ground, the plane started to spin. My legs gave way as I ran.
Herring and the chief of the 2nd Army Air Service, Colonel Frank Lahm, were the first people to reach the crash site. Herring tried to pull Hobie from the crumpled plane, now embedded into the muddy earth. But Hobie's leg was trapped in the wreckage, so Lahm used an axe to cut Hobie free. When they removed his helmet, Hobie's golden locks fell across his blood-stained face. A deep 5-inch gash ran down the middle of Hobie's forehead, the result of slamming his head into the forward machine gun. There was so much blood that at first Lahm didn't recognize Hobie. As Herring and Lahm pulled Hobie's limp body from the wreckage, he passed away in Herring's arms. He was only 26 years old.
The death of Hobie Baker is a tragically ironic story that happens more than not in the story of military aviation.
The Smithsonian's Jeremy Kinney.
In the worst weather imaginable, Baker takes this airplane up, and what happens? The engine cuts out. And an experienced pilot would just put it straight down, let it glide down and be done with it. But as a squadron commander, he turns back towards the airfield. And in the process of turning, he starts losing lift. So he puts the nose down, which gives you speed. It's almost like a roller coaster. If he had 90 more feet, he would have just kind of glided in and landed, but the SPAD hits the ground and crashes.
F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote years later, perhaps thinking of Hobie, "Show me a hero, and I'll write you a tragedy." To this day, there remain lingering questions about Hobie's untimely death. Was it an unfortunate accident, or just bad judgment fueled by the overconfidence of a talented flyer? Or was it deliberate? Sam Slaughter was a pilot assigned to Hobie's command.
Had he more altitude, he could have put his ship into a nosedive and then pulled out before he hit the ground. All of us were told never to try a turn near the ground with a dead stick. But Hobie was as near to being Superman as a human can get, and he didn't live according to the book.
And here's what his former commander, Charlie Biddle, wrote about Hobie's death.
As anyone who knew Baker well should know, he was not the kind of man who would deliberately end his life. While I was not there at the time of the accident, I've talked to numerous men who were there and saw what happened. If he had wanted to kill himself, he could have done so easily by diving into the ground instead of trying to extricate himself from his troubles, as eyewitnesses described and photos confirm.
In his own detailed description of the crash, Herring noted that Hobie may have saved himself if he hadn't decided to try and make it back to the field.
Quite possibly, Hobie could have held the SPAD's nose up long enough to clear the telegraph wires and stone barracks and land in the plowed land behind. He would have washed out the plane, but he might have got out without serious injury to himself. I had seen crashes on the hard ground where the plane was demolished, and the pilot walked away with not even a bloody nose.
Baker biographer Emil Salvini is unpersuaded by the arguments that Hobie's death was merely a tragic accident or bad judgment.
If you've seen pictures of the wreck, it looked like he took a nosedive, you know, right into the ground. He didn't try to pancake it at all. I know he did not want to go back to being a trainee banker.
Salvini believes there is a strong possibility that Hobie died by his own hand.
Yes, that he committed suicide. As a matter of fact, if I had to say yes or no, I'd say he probably did.
With us now aware of Hobie's emotional backstory, we can speculate about his state of mind that late December day in France. Was he perhaps afraid of returning to an America that was increasingly turning against gay and bisexual men? Professor Nicholas Surrett.
I think it's possible even a man like Hobie, who did not present as effeminate in any way, indeed was a sort of model of masculinity for all of his classmates, indeed for the nation, could come to understand himself perhaps as that kind of thing that he maybe did not want himself to be. I think even more plausible, though, is simply what might have been going on in his own head about whether he wanted to have a life that would put him outside the mainstream. If he had come to understand that his emotional and erotic attractions were really primarily to men and were not going to be satisfied to women, is that the kind of life that he wants to lead, either as a closeted person or shunned by some people in society around him?
It's also likely that Hobie was feeling unsettled and ambivalent about returning home. Going from his sports glory at Princeton to wartime glory in France, and now seeing little in his future to match the exuberant adrenaline highs of his heroic past. If his plane had landed safely, Hobie contemplated the possibility of mindless work on Wall Street, waning looks, and fading adoration. Salvini sees tragedy in Hobie's rigid commitment to sports amateurism, a dogma that prevented him from becoming a professional hockey player and pursuing a career he would have found satisfying after the war.
I would have loved to have seen him play, but I feel that the greatest irony in his life was that his entire amateur athletic career prepared him for doing what his social class and conscience would never let him do, and that was to play sports for money, which could have solved problems in his life if he had made it home.
But Hobie didn't make it home. And a few months after the crash, Hef Herring was tasked with bringing Hobie's personal effects and his letters back safely from France. He placed them in a satchel bag and headed to the Paris rail station. Inside was the silver cigarette case engraved with 2HAHB from PRP II, September 15, 1914. That was the date of Percy and Hobie moving in together in New York City. In addition, the satchel also contained dozens of what must have been intimate letters from Percy to Hobie. Herring maintained that the satchel was stolen from between his legs at the Paris train station. Yet somehow, the cigarette case managed to make its way to Princeton's special collections. Salvini believes that the loss of the satchel containing Percy's letters might not have been a theft, after all.
The Pine family was very powerful and had a lot of connections, and they might have been intentionally destroyed. But it also could have been, yes, somebody just very close to Hobie that felt they were for Hobie's eyes only, maybe, and destroyed them.
It was Percy whom the U.S. War Department first notified about Hobie's death, not his father, nor his brother Thornton. To deal with his emotional loss and honor Hobie Baker's legacy, Percy soon launched a campaign to fund a fitting athletic memorial to him. The Hobie Baker Memorial Ice Rink, dedicated in 1923, 5 years after Hobie's death, was the first college hockey arena in the country. A century later, Princeton's hockey team still plays there. And displayed prominently in the Princeton locker room is this simple phrase, "Make Hobie proud." Today, the Baker Rink stands as a stone and mortar symbol of one man's love for another. Percy's for Hobie.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hobie Baker Memorial Rink. Tonight, Princeton Tigers play the Bulldogs of Yale.
After raising the funds for Baker Rink, Percy sunk into alcoholism and lost much of his inherited fortune in the 1929 stock market crash. In 1950, Percy died almost penniless in a shotgun house in California's San Fernando Valley. He was 68 years old. Meanwhile, Hobie's brother, Thornton, never got to attend Princeton or any college. But as a tribute to Thornton's selfless decision to let his younger brother go to Princeton instead of him, Thornton was made an honorary member of Hobie's class, the Princeton class of 1914. To honor Hobie, Thornton named his first son, Hobie Baker Jr. His wife, Marie, compiled a large scrapbook of Hobie Baker memorabilia and newspaper clippings that are a permanent part of the Baker archive at Princeton's Mudd Library. So, as we look back on Hobie's life and legacy, questions remain. Was Hobie Baker, one of America's first iconic athletes, same-sex loving? Or has our new reading of the historical record led us down the wrong path? We will never know the full extent of Hobie's and Percy's relationship. But the countless letters and remembrances attest to the fact that theirs was clearly a relationship beyond friendship. It was intimate, playful, loving, and most likely romantic. More than a century after Hobie played, college and professional hockey and football still remain unwelcoming places for gay and bisexual male athletes. In fact, entering the 2023-24 hockey season, there's yet to be an out gay or bisexual player in the NHL. To date, the only two out gay athletes in the NFL had very brief tenures. Hobie's lasting impact on American sports remains the Hobie Baker Award, the award given annually to the top men's college ice hockey player, equivalent to college football's famed Heisman Trophy.
The Hobie Baker Memorial Award winner is Johnny Gaudreau.
Since 1981, the Hobie Baker Award Committee honors Hobie by choosing winners not merely based on their athletic prowess or stats alone, but for exhibiting strength of character, integrity, and sportsmanship. Traits that Hobie fully embodied. Yet, for the most part, Hobie's incredible athletic exploits have been lost to history, and his renowned legacy flattened into a mere name on a trophy. Today, Hobie Baker lies buried in a cemetery near his Philadelphia mainline home. Etched on his tombstone is an epitaph that captures the tragedy and enigma of his all-too-brief life.
"You, who seemed winged even as a lad, with that swift look of those who know the sky, it was no blundering fate that stooped and bade you break your wings and fall to the earth and die. I think someday You may have flown too high, so that immortals saw you and were glad, watching the beauty of your spirit's flame, until they loved and called you, and you came.
Searching for Hobie Baker was narrated by David Duchovny. The series was executive produced by Ross Greenberg, Andrew Reynolds, and Timothy Smith. From Silver Sound, the producer and re-recording mixer for the production was Corey Choi. The supervising sound designer was Luke Allen. Our original music and music supervision was done by John Sands and Wayne Sharp. The associate producer for this podcast was Evan Janikin. Also from Silver Sound, additional producing by Hunt Beatty and Reed Adler. Studio recording by Tom Fama. Location recording by Tarcisio Longobardi and Christian Cuccinello. And script support by Wenri Zhao. Special thanks to Stephen Arcieri and Matt Brody from Arcieri Talent. Our production manager was Christina DeLeggi, and the production accountant was Donna Brucale. Legal services provided by Jordan Mannequin and Sam Bayard for 30 for 30 podcasts. This episode was produced by Carolyn Hepburn, Tara Nadalny, and Adiza Egan. Our line producer was Kath Sankey. Senior editorial producer for 30 for 30 podcasts was Preethi Varathan. The associate producers were Gus Navarro and Isabella Seaman. Production assistants were Diamante McKelvey and Anthony Salas. Senior producers are Marquise Daisy and Gentry Kirby. Heather Anderson, Marsha Cook, Brian Lockhart, and Burke Magnus are executive producers for 30 for 30 and ESPN Films. Rights and clearances by Jennifer Thorpe and Cal Griffith. Fact-checking by Daniel Tomorrow and Andrew Disler. This podcast was developed by Eve Tro, Adam Newhouse, and Trevor Gill.